Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello. Welcome to another episode of Ancient Office Hours by the Ozymandias Project. Trireme Transit is now boarding for all new and returning passengers. Now departing, present ponderings. Next stop is Ancient Office Hours at a library lost in the sands of time.
Hey everyone, and welcome to episode 79 of Ancient Office Hours. This week, I got to speak with a fellow gamer and history lover, Megan Sullivan, host of the History and Games podcast. Her show is a video and audio podcast that celebrates history by revealing the most sensational, real stories hidden inside our favorite video games. She has worked for IGN and Apple and has been a history consultant on projects. I want to quickly thank Dr. Jackson Crawford for introducing us and making this podcast episode a reality. In this episode, we chatted about how and why she started History and Games, how to balance personal and professional gaming desires, her process of finding history in games, and how to prioritize games when there's almost too much content. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and if you like what you hear, please give us a 5-star rating and review us on Apple or Spotify. You can also subscribe to our Patreon, as this will allow us to reach more people and make more exciting ancient world content. Enjoy! Awesome sauce. So thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. I want to start you off with probably, hopefully, a pretty easy question, which is, when did you get super into ancient history? And, or I, we could go more broadly, history and video games.
So kind of at the same time, when I was a kid growing up, I was surrounded by history lovers. So there was always history books around, and I was huge into Greek mythology as a kid, like love Greek mythology. So I feel like that was kind of the real start of my love of history, is it started with like all the crazy stories from Greek and Norse mythology, stuff like that. And then with video games, we had, I mean, this is way back, so I was really little, but we had like an Atari 2600 in our house. So my older siblings would be playing on that. And I grew up in the 80s and 90s, so arcades were still a thing. So video games and history were always kind of part of my life.
Nice. That's awesome. And so, like, was there a pull between them? Did you see them as they could always kind of work together? Or were you kind of like, no, maybe I should, you know, focus more on the history side or more on the gaming side?
So I actually am called, I'm part of the generation called the Oregon Trail generation. So we grew up playing Oregon Trail in school. And so I always kind of knew that games and history could go together well. Like I recognized very early on the, you know, power of education that video games can provide. So I loved Oregon Trail growing up. And so it never occurred to me those two things couldn't go together, because all of those educational, or they called edutainment games, came out at the same time. It was like math games and history games, and they worked. They were really fun to play. So I've always loved both of them together.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Did you ever get sort of called out by either parents or peers who maybe didn't understand this weird fascination that we history gamers have, just for like having our head in the clouds? Like, did you encounter the people who were kind of just like, man, you're just mushing your brain. You can't actually learn anything from a video game.
No, I got really lucky, because I had good grades in like high school, and not so much like the first couple years of middle school, because I just wanted to play video games all the time. But as long as I got good grades, then my parents didn't mind if I played video games. And, you know, by then edutainment games were pretty well known. So every once in a while, I'd be like, here's a strategy game that's based on like the Civil War or the Peloponnesian War. And so you could make the argument, well, those are kind of educational. You know, I can learn history from The Legend of Zelda, which is true. I have History and Games episodes about the history found in Legend of Zelda. So as long as I kept my grades up, my parents were like, go for it. Have fun with video games.
Oh, you were lucky then, because my experience was so different. It was such a struggle because I definitely had parents who, my parents were very set, and they were the ones who were like, we will not buy you a gaming system because it will mush your brain and you won't go outside and play with your friends. And they were definitely of the it'll mush your brain generation. So it was pretty funny. I could only like sneak away to my cousin's house in Michigan, and they had a PS2. So I remember feeling all cool when I was like gaming on their PlayStation. And then like, no wonder they thought it was like this weird cycle where they thought it really was doing the worst, because every time we went there, which was pretty infrequent, like twice a year, maybe for a couple of days. So any chance I got, I was like, okay, now I have to take advantage of all the time I have, and I'm just going to like constantly game. So every time we would go up there, they'd only see me like addicted to the gaming system, which really didn't help my case, because I would tell them, you know, if I had one, I would not be on it all the time, because then I wouldn't be stressed that I wouldn't have time to game. But I didn't.
Right. You got
to
get those gaming hours in while you can.
Exactly. So like I would literally game until I fell asleep. And so like, I remember my parents would like come in to my cousin's like bedroom where they had a TV and their PlayStation, and they'd like find me asleep with the controller basically in my hand. And then when I'd wake up, they'd be like, see, this is why nothing good comes from this. Bad.
Right.
So it finally turned around when the Wii came out, because my dad decided he wanted the benefits of being able to be, you know, do something physical with the Wii. So then I kind of got around the weird no gaming system rule, because I bought myself like the GameCube controller, and I would only hook it up to the Wii when my dad was not around, and then I could play some GameCube. But
that's very clever, by the way. That's a great way to do it. The GameCube controller is the best.
Oh, thank you. I know, I miss the old gaming systems, actually. It's like, but you know, the games have gotten better now, so I can't really complain. But I'm curious, because I was really excited when I heard about your own podcast, History and Games. Can you tell us all a little bit about, you know, when did you have the idea to create the show, and just a little bit about it? Because I feel like there's a lot of crossover between the gaming fans who probably listen to my show, might be looking for something else.
Well, so History and Games is a video and audio podcast where we celebrate the educational power of video games. So no matter how wacky and weird things get in video games, the truth is always wackier and crazier still. And I like to celebrate that. I like to find fun angles that make history exciting and that make history relevant. But the narrative arc of History and Games is kind of unusual. It actually started off as a Twitch stream back in 2015, because Twitch was blowing up then. People were, you know, reported to make millions of dollars. We all wanted on the Twitch hype train, but I couldn't figure out, like, how was I going to stick out in a crowded sea of millions of people who are all screaming at their, you know, computer screens while playing games. I wanted to do something different. And I was like, I don't know, what can I do? What do I know besides video games? And I was like, I know history. Maybe I'll play history-based games and talk about the history. So it was a Twitch stream for a couple of years, but I had a small kind of devoted little audience, but they never wanted to talk about history. They always wanted to talk about other stuff that I was known for, because I worked at IGN for over a decade. So people know me for my love of RPGs and wrestling and anime and all that sort of nerdy pop culture stuff. And that's all they wanted to talk about. And I realized that I had a good idea with History and Games, but I didn't have the right format. So I started doing an audio podcast in 2019. And then by 2020, I had an Elgato capture card where I could actually do a YouTube version of the podcast as well. And I've sort of been doing that ever since.
Oh, that's pretty fun. So, I mean, I guess the big question for me and maybe people in my audience would be, you know, do you try to seek out specifically history games that definitely have it as a huge part of their branding, or are you more just like find any game and then find the history in it, so you go broader than the types of games that I normally game with or talk about?
So it started off as looking at games that had history in it. So like I did an early episode on the Oregon Trail, because it's right there, right? Like that is a history-based game. The whole point was to be accurate and fun, and it was. But then I started realizing, as I was playing games, almost every game has a really cool historical slant. Usually games borrow from different histories around the world, different cultures. And so, like, you know, if you can take any game, like I said, like The Legend of Zelda, or, you know, Final Fantasy, and you can actually find history hidden in these games. I thought the oddest one that I found this whole hidden history of was in Fire Emblem Three Houses, which was a really popular game from 2019. And I initially didn't know how to cover that game. But then while I was playing it, I was like, there's this crazy backstory, like, that's really confusing. But then when you peel back the layers, like, oh my God, this is based on ancient Egyptian history and ancient Greek history. I gotta do something with this. So it's kind of based on games that are already tied to history, but the fun is really finding popular contemporary games and being like, hey, they touched on this piece of history that not a lot of people know about.
Yeah, makes sense. I mean, so stuff that's not super on the nose. I don't want to say like a hesitant gamer, but I definitely came at it from the other way, where to be interested in a game, unfortunately, I feel like I need to find the history right away. It needs to be kind of right in my face before I'm like, okay, I'll go and game through that and see what it's like. But, you know, I've been away from my PS4 for the last year while studying in Europe, so I've been behind in my games. But yeah, you know, I've just been playing through the newest two Dark Pictures games, and I know one of them's right in that history and horror sweet spot, like Ancient Sumerians and Curse of Akkad and all that. And then the other one's quite a bit more contemporary, but it's still pleasurable.
Yeah, see, and that's great, because I cannot play horror games. Like, I am the biggest coward. So it's really cool that somebody is covering that, because I can't. It's like the one genre that I freeze every time someone, oh, have you played Resident Evil? Have you played Silent Hill? I'm like, nope, and I probably never will. It's too scary. So I'm glad that you're covering those games.
Within reason, because the thing is, I am actually a big fraidy cat. I am so scared of horror. Like, I don't watch horror movies, so it doesn't actually make sense that I like these horror games, quote unquote. I think it, you know, it started because, again, I was off on like a history tangent, and then someone said back in 2015 or whatever, oh, have you played Until Dawn? There's a ton of like Native American mythology in it, and, you know, I think it'd be really cool. And I remember just thinking, oh, well, no, because I don't like horror, but I guess maybe I'll try. And thankfully, like, no one told me exactly how scary it was. They said, oh, you know, it's a bit scary, but, you know, the story will take over. So I thought, okay, it probably won't be that bad. I made the mistake of playing it with a friend. We started it at like 10 p.m. in pitch darkness.
Oh, jeez.
And then because it's like a 10, 11 hour playthrough, we played it through in that one night, and I, of course, was screaming like half the night and for the next few days. And anytime someone like came into the house, I was screaming. But it was worth it, because they were right. Like, the story was good enough, and I was intrigued by sort of the mystery of it. But yeah, it was terrifying.
Well, still braver than I can't even play certain games. Like, I couldn't even get through like half of BioShock in the daytime, or Demon Souls in the daytime, because I was just literally white knuckling the whole time my controller. I was like, oh my gosh, what's gonna happen next?
Well, there's this whole subgenre of ancient history, particularly with horror. So I'm almost curious, like, would it be easier to get through it if you played it not alone? Like, yes, of course, in the daytime and stuff, but if you had someone like sitting next to you analyzing the history as you go along, would that make it less scary, I wonder?
It might make it less scary, but it sort of depends. Like, I know my friends, they would just tease me relentlessly. Like, even if they're history and experts, they would sit there and deliberately try to scare me the whole time. They would just punk me the entire time. So if I could have someone guaranteed not to like deliberately try to jump scare me, then maybe I could do it. but I don't trust my friends to be the ones to do it.
Yeah, no, I get that. That must be hard because I definitely have friends who would probably jump scare me. But at the same time, I don't know. You know what? Maybe it would be an exercise in trust just without the physical falling exercise, right? Where
right.
Can I pick you? Can I designate you and trust you to not scare me? Might be kind of a fun experiment.
It might be, but we would have to see.
Well, okay. Well, we can... If any friends are listening to this, please don't scare me, because I'd like to play more horror games, because there are some really cool looking ones, but I'm very scared, so don't scare me. Yeah, we'll try that trust exercise later. But yeah, I want to get into it. So you said that you were with IGN for a while. Now, is this, okay, I'll back up for a minute. I know what IGN is. I don't know if people more on the history side know more than just it reviews video games. Can we back up and can you just explain sort of what you did for IGN before I get into the next set of questions?
Sure. So IGN is a video game and sort of pop culture website that does like reviews and previews and interviews for video games and like big pop culture movies, like the Marvel movies and comics and all the nerdy pop culture stuff. And for 13 years, I was actually one of their database editors. So I was mostly behind the scenes. So we would put in facts and information about games and we would attach them to what's called an object so that whenever you looked for a game on IGN, all the video, all the information would come up in one place. So that was my main job. But over the years, they let me sort of come out and review video games and do interviews and features and podcasts. So I got a lot of experience doing sort of the whole gambit at IGN, which was a lot of fun. And it mostly reviewed like role-playing games, which is what I'm kind of known for. But I think it surprises people when they find out it's like, oh, I also love God of War and Borderlands and things like that. But I'm mostly known for RPGs. Sorry. So that's what I did for over a decade.
And is this like a job that you could foresee? Like, is this really a job that a gamer has to do? Or could someone with a history background, like a classics major, but who just doesn't want to go into academia, could they do it?
So, I mean, if you have any kind of like copywriting background or writing background, you could definitely do this, you know, type of job that I did, the database side. You're really just curating content. And so the history part didn't really come into play at all. The history part came in when I left IGN because I'd kind of done the whole gambit there. Like there was nothing else to really to do. So I briefly worked at Apple, which I have nothing bad to say about. It was a good experience. It was just a 4-hour commute every day. And I was like, I can't do 4 hours. This is ridiculous. But they're very strict about not letting people work from home. And this was before COVID. So I decided to take a year off and be like, well, what do I want to be when I grow up? And that's sort of when the podcast of History and Games started. So that's where the history part comes in. And now I do a lot of freelancing for either reviews or video game consultations to help pay the bills. So, yep, that's what I do.
Hey, I mean, it sounds exciting because I think, you know, when coming at it from a more academic background, a ton of friends within the field, they always kind of grumble. And I hear, you know, we're talking about, well, I like doing this thing and I like games or TV and film, but it's hard because you can't make it a full-time job. And then you're like, well, I gotta keep teaching on the side. So I don't know. Yeah, everyone's path is super unique. Yours for sure sounds super unique, but yeah, I don't know. It's I don't know why it shouldn't be such a struggle, right, to mix love of history and some any kind of research background with doing something a little different, a little non-traditional. I don't know why it's so hard.
And it is absolutely possible. I mean, I don't know if your audience is familiar with Dr. Jackson Crawford, who is a Norse mythology and language specialist, and he has a whole YouTube channel in which he teaches people, you know, the Norse language and the history and culture. And it's really cool. And of course, he is in the academic world. He's taught at several prestigious colleges. But it's absolutely possible to sort of find your niche and do what you love. But, you know, I got to warn people, you got to be patient, right? Like you got to build that audience. You got to figure out what it is that you can do that's unique and fun. But if you're really passionate about it, I encourage people to go for it. You know, like if you have to keep your day job for a while, that's okay. But don't give up on your dreams.
For sure. For sure. I completely agree. That's kind of why I podcast, just because it's a dream and I want to keep it going. But I also have a day job because I can't
make right?
it just with my show. So you do what you gotta kind of have to do out of desperation.
Exactly.
Exactly, right? I'm like, it's always a side hustle, but it's going to be a good one.
You got to do the hustle, but we're going to make it. We are.
But yeah, so for people who might want to check out your show, I mean, I don't know. I've glanced at it just because I will admit I was not familiar with it until it was suggested to me by Dr. Crawford himself. But, you know, so I'm curious to know, you do have a great capacity for history, and obviously you have all this gaming. So I'm curious to know, what is a game, not Zelda, but a game that has surprised you with the amount of historical material or something that you found really cool that you've been able to cover?
Let's see. So I mentioned Fire Emblem Three Houses before. That was the biggest surprise, because I honestly generally did not know how to cover that game. And then I found all this stuff sort of hidden in the background. And that was just such a cool surprise. It's not really surprising, but it was so much fun to cover Assassin's Creed Odyssey, which takes place during the Peloponnesian War. But my very first episode of History and Games was breaking down three things, which is it possible that King Leonidas had, you know, a royal grandchild that was a mercenary? Were there such things as Spartan mercenaries? Did Leonidas have direct descendants, et cetera, et cetera? So I broke down all of these type of questions and I answered them. And I found the answers really, really interesting. And that was sort of the catalyst for doing even more episodes of History and Games. Just finding those little surprising details in history that tie directly into games and vice versa is so much fun that I have to like share it with people. I'm like, you guys, if you played this game, you're not going to believe how it ties into history. Or if you know this history, did you know it's referenced in this game? So like I just did an episode on like Assassin's Creed codename Jade and how a very popular Assassin's Creed character could end up being in that game, not just because fantasy reasons, but there's real historical precedent. Like that is so much fun to figure out. So I'm always kind of surprised, but even if it's a straightforward history and game, like games episode, there's something in the details where I sort of dig it up and I'm like, ooh, this is treasure and I gotta show it with the world. I've gotta share it with the world.
Nice. I mean, like any history nerd, we have a capacity to love so many different kinds of history, but do you have a favorite that you like to cover, a certain type of mythology, or, you know, maybe even a certain personage from mythology?
I think for me, it's sort of a tie between ancient Greek history, which is what I know the most, like that's where I'm most comfortable, like people can tell, and then ancient Japanese history, which I've been hugely into Japanese culture since I was, you know, young as well. Thank you, Sailor Moon. So that was, I know anime is always the gateway drug into Japanese culture. It's awesome. And so I think those two are kind of pretty much my favorites because that's sort of what I know the best. I guess you could say Tudor England as well, because I find that whole thing a giant soap opera. I can never get enough of it. I think my blind spot in history would have to be like 20th century history, because it's so dark and grim and it's too recent. So it doesn't feel great to cover because it's so depressing. Right. And whereas, you know, ancient stuff feels almost like reading about a fantasy world. Right. Like it's, you know, a lot of fantasy books that I'm really into are based on ancient cultures because it's so far from our modern world. So I think that's why I always love like ancient Greek or ancient Persian or ancient Egyptian history, stuff like that. But definitely ancient Greek and ancient Japanese history for sure. What about you?
Well, I majored in classics all through undergrad, so definitely my great weakness is my love for Greek mythology. But you know, for me, the gateway drug, and for a lot of people, I don't know, it's different because either I've noticed you either get into anime and then suddenly you're into Japanese stuff, or for me, the gateway drug was ancient Egypt in sixth grade, because I had such a great sixth grade history teacher, and we like read all the myths and stuff, but Yeah, so I like to pretend I'm an armchair Egyptologist and, you know, try to judge things, which doesn't always turn out well. But luckily, as an adult, you know what? I have enough friends who are actually Egyptologists that I feel more confident being like, yes, I've picked this up. I know this. But no, I'm not an expert in it.
That's so romantic, though, that just everyone loves ancient Egypt. And it's so funny you mentioned sixth grade specifically, because about that's when I started getting into ancient cultures, is because I think it's part of the curriculum to introduce ancient Egyptian mythology and history at that point. I remember reading a book about Cleopatra in sixth or seventh grade and being like, and this is the very end of, you know, kind of ancient Egyptian history, and just being like, oh my gosh, now I got to read about all this other stuff.
Yeah, well, did you catch on the popular trend where I think at that time, fifth, sixth grade, they had released, what was it called? Pharaoh, right? It was like the original Pharaoh game where it's kind of like a early SimCity type city builder thing, but you built like ancient Egypt and you had your little Pharaoh and you'd like decorate the palace and stuff. And so you could sort of sit there and imagine what great empire you're going to build. And then.
No, I missed that somehow. And I'm sorry I did. That sounds awesome.
There's a remake. They're making a remake. And I don't know when it's going to be released. But I'm like so hyped for it. I'm like, I'm waiting.
All right. I'm going to look that up later. I'm going to figure that out, because that does. It sounds amazing. I know there's a game coming out called Builders of Greece. I'm really, really looking forward to, where I think you build basically Greek civilization. I don't know if you start with the Minoans or not. I can't remember off the top of my head, but it just looks like a really fun game. And I'm not sure if it's turn-based or real-time strategy, but whatever it is, it looks really cool.
Yeah. I mean, I would say my personal preference has also trended toward more like open world RPG type things too. But I will say, like, early on, again, because I couldn't have gaming systems, like, my only backup was I had laptops and stuff, so I had to PC game, you know, super old school. So, yeah, I had a lot of the slower, yeah, like, SimCity type of things. I had Pharaoh, and I grew up playing Civilization IV, which, throwback.
Oh, that's definitely a throwback. I was trying to play Civilization 6 on my computer, and I was told just the other day, my graphics card isn't good enough. And I'm like, but my computer is pretty new. What gives? Because these games are just so massive, right? Like, they're so rich in detail. And I'm like, let me play Hojo Tokimune. I'm like slamming down on my mouse. Like, come on, just let me in.
No, it's like super annoying when you can't. Although I will admit, I didn't get into Civ 6 because I'm like a hardcore Civ 5 person. And I know there's like that big argument or rivalry over which is better, 5 or 6. And I definitely land on the Civ 5 side. But so that's like the only game that I really play that's not on my PS4 these days. I have it on Steam on my laptop. So I don't know what the graphics look like, but I don't game for public consumption. I just game for me. And I tend to spend a ton of hours on Civ.
I have to game for public consumption because I have my history and games YouTube channel, but then I have my regular Meg Sullivan YouTube channel. So like this year has been jammed with video games that, you know, back to back to back to back review, and they're all massive and they're all huge and I'm going crazy. It's a great problem to have, but man, I can't remember the last time I just gamed. I think the only game that I've done privately is Final Fantasy 14. I think that's the only one I haven't constantly like talked about. It's like, no, this is my world. This is my imagination. Just let me be a Benny girl.
The struggle is so real. The struggle is so real. But it is. It does sound like a really great problem to have, because you always want too many games instead of too few. I definitely feel like.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, Well, and then there's some games that, like, people use that I would never even assume. Like, someone was using Super Smash Bros. Brawl to do some sort of history thing. And I was like, wait, what? I haven't played that since I was, like, 15. Do I need to go back and find the history in it? What am I missing?
See, that's exactly the kind of content I love. Like, I want to go look that up. Like, what is the historical slant of Super Smash Brothers? I got to know, because I honestly did not think that there would be some sort of historical precedent for it. But I'm clearly wrong. And I love that. That is exactly the kind of content that I want to make and consume.
Yes, yes. I want to learn more about it myself. I mean, yeah, I have so many questions. Because I'm like, well, is it the characters from these certain franchises that make it historical when you put them together? But someone was saying it was about, like, the level settings. There was, like, they used history to create them. And I was like, I need to research this. Like, what is happening here? I don't know what's happening. Yeah, there's so much. But there's so much there, not only that, like, in games that you want to discover, but, like, do you feel this way for the history side, too, where you're kind of like, I want to learn more about this other history that I don't know about, but I have no time to do it, but I want to.
I mean, this year it feels so frustrating to have to, like, sift through all these games and then be like, which game do I want to cover? Which one will have a really cool history angle, and which ones do I have to kind of put to the side? So it kind of depends. Like, I was actually in the middle of a big review, and then the trailer for Assassin's Creed Codename Jade dropped, and I immediately could think of a historical angle. And I was like, I got to drop everything and focus on this first. The world has to know I have this idea about how we can connect Assassin's Creed Odyssey and Codename Jade together. Like, I knew off the top of my head, because I had just done a history in games that kind of did something similar a year ago. And I was like, this is awesome. But there are times that I'm just like, you know, I really want to cover this. I want to learn more about it, but I just don't have the time to research this, particularly if it's like a big subject, right? Like, at one point for Fire Emblem Three Houses, I was thinking, okay, well, maybe this game is based, you know, there's some Celtic mythology in here, but also maybe I can parallel it to the Holy Roman Empire. But no matter what, I struggled to, like, figure out a good angle. So before I stumbled on, like, the ancient Egyptian and Greek stuff, it took me months to puzzle out. I knew I wanted to cover the game, but I couldn't figure out how. And so I was going to shove it off to the side and be like, I just can't find that angle. I just don't have time to research it. So it does happen, you know, where it's just like you try to suss out a really good idea, but you can't quite do it. And sometimes you're just like, I just don't have time. I got to let this go and go on to other stuff, which is always too bad.
I know.
But you can always come back around to it.
That's true. Especially when you work with, like, ancient history stuff, you know it's going to be there forever.
Yeah, exactly. There's no rush.
It's not going anywhere. So you're like, exactly. So you can just kind of be like, all right, next time. Yeah, that was kind of me this year. I have made a concerted effort to get more into Old Norse studies and learn more about ancient Scandinavia. But it just seems like there's never enough time because I get pulled into something or other. But then again, I do also a lot of reception stuff for TV and film. So that does unfortunately draw my attention away from games, which, yes, I like watching and consuming this other media, but then I never have enough time for the games. So it's a bit hard. I don't know. Do you have that problem as well? Do you kind of find yourself maybe getting drawn by some other form of media that's not gaming, or are you pretty able to stay focused and be like, no, there's just so much here that I don't need to be distracted by the other stuff?
So I'm not a huge TV movie person. So I'm kind of lucky that the two hobbies I love most are video games and reading. And so that just slides in nicely with history. I'm not like my family loves movies. Like, they could sit down and watch like 10 movies in a row and never move. But I am super energetic and hyper. And I'm like, I don't know how you sit still that long. I don't know how you could possibly do this. So, but for some reason I can sit there and play 10 hours of Harvest Moon and not have a problem with it. Right. Like, it's kind of weird. So luckily I've never had that issue where there's some other form of media distracting me. Like, it's always game related. I'm in the industry. And it's my preferred way to sort of relax and pass the time. So I just got really lucky that I'm always reading about history or playing games about history. So it does make my life easier. It's just that this year there is so much content to consume as a gamer that the biggest stress is figuring out how to cover it all or how to prioritize one game or another. It's weirdly stressful, but like I said, it's like a good kind of stress.
Well, you're definitely lucky, because I would love to not have my attention split in like 3 or 4 different ways, because I want to get to all of the things, but there's not enough hours in life to do so.
Right? There's so much content to consume, too. Like, it's insane. Like, I used to watch wrestling all the time. And then I finally just let it go. There was actually too much content to keep up with, or the same with like TV shows. I finally got burnt out on the MCU because I wasn't able to keep up with everything that they were coming out with. I was like, I need a breather here, Marvel.
I know. It's literally insane. Cause I mean, it kind of makes sense, right? Cause we are in this like overwhelming digital media age, whatever, where it's not like, you know, if I want to see the thing I want to see, I got to wait for it to come on Saturday morning cartoons at 10 a.m. and then I can catch it there, or else it's gone for another week or something. So we're super oversaturated now. So for sure, I think our brains are split in more ways than ever. And it's only going to get worse. It's not going to get better. So, I mean, kudos.
Yeah, really.
That you don't have this problem. But I don't know, like, so, and when you're covering, like, historical elements and things within the game, I'm a little curious, like, do you like to cover some of the stuff that almost, like, I wouldn't consider it, but, like, other people might consider it sort of the minutiae within, so there's, like, the surface level, how does this connect to a history or a mythology kind of on the surface, but do you pay attention to stuff like ancient-inspired music in games, and I guess when I'm saying this, I'm thinking actively of like the Assassin's Creed games, because for me it's become an obsession that I like listen to these soundtracks because they sound like the ancient environments that they're recreating.
Did you notice that there actually is an ancient Greek song in Odyssey that plays?
Yeah.
And they have a couple of them in there. And I think one is an ode to the sun, and I can't remember what the name of the other one is, but I immediately recognized it walking around. I was like, oh my God, these people have done their research. Bless them. I'm always so impressed with Ubisoft's ability to just really deep dive. I mean, I was looking around as Cassandra. I was looking around in Assassin's Creed Odyssey, Athens, and I was on top of the Parthenon. And I was like, if I turn left and look slightly down, there should be the Temple of Hephaestus there. If I look over towards the west, that should be the Piraeus. If I look this way, I should be facing north. And everywhere I faced was exactly where things were supposed to be. And I was really impressed. I was like, oh my gosh, like I actually can get my bearings in this game. That is crazy. So I actually platinumed. I don't usually chase trophies in video games, but I got the platinum trophy for that game because I could not stop playing it. I loved it so much. The details were so incredible. They don't miss.
No, oh my gosh, wait. You're literally describing me. Like, I don't care about platinuming games unless I there's a reason that I really love it. But yeah, that was like the first Assassin's Creed that I was like, I have to platinum it in every way possible, and it's a bit shameful, but I think I have like, I definitely have over 1,000 hours played in it.
It makes sense. It absolutely makes sense. I never finished the final DLC because I don't think I ever wanted to come out of the game. Like, I'm one of those people where sometimes I'll put off the ending of a book or a movie or a TV show or something because I'm like, I don't really want this to end. So I know I'm supposed to be talking to Persephone in the game right now, the DLC, and I'm like, I can't move forward. I'm stuck. Because I don't think I want to leave it behind, because it's like, I don't want Cassandra's story to end. It's just, it was so good.
No, I definitely did that. I like had a billion, I created like 2 new save files, so I never had to, you know, I could get close, but never actually poke the final bear. Like if I accidentally triggered the final cutscene, I could be like, nope, delete this, go right back to that save file. But yeah, and they were like massive DLCs too. They weren't just like little things.
No, they weren't. They're big DLC, like huge in content. So I appreciate that.
Like 3 whole chapters. So yeah, no, I definitely platinum the crap out of Odyssey. But I don't know, have you gone through Valhalla or Origins?
So I didn't play Valhalla, or I haven't played Valhalla yet. It's not that I don't want to, but there was never time. And I knew the game was huge and other games had to take priority. So time just kept passing. And then people started having split opinions on it. Either people really loved it or they were kind of meh on it. I do plan to play Assassin's Creed Mirage, though, which takes place in like the Middle Ages outside of Baghdad. And it sounds really cool. I'm not sure how I feel about it going back to the original Assassin's Creed formula. I always had mixed feelings about the first 3 or 4 games, but I'm looking forward to the history and story a lot. So I will definitely play that game. And then one day I will play Valhalla. I just don't know when I'm going to have time. It's not going to be in 2023. I can tell you that. It is two stack a year.
Yeah, no, it's huge. I didn't think I realized how big it was going to be. I mean, because from my perspective, I was sitting here like, Odyssey was freaking huge. It took a billion hours. Like, oh God, I don't know if I can handle something that. But then it was marketed to me as it's shorter than Odyssey. So then I was like, oh great. So it'll be shorter. We're good. Yeah, it still took like 60 hours to get through the main storyline. So I was like, oh God.
Yeah.
And then they added so many DLCs and other things to it. Then I was like, yeah, no, I can't save it. It's huge. But yeah, you know, I would say that was the game that finally got me on to it, like, kicked my ass into gear to really start to prioritize getting into the Scandinavian mythology and the history, because I didn't, like, I knew it, because that's the thing, this big game would open the can of worms, and I was like, I was not prepared to go down this, and it seemed too big, but then I started the game, and then I was like, well, I don't like going through this not knowing the historical references.
Right.
It was a bit uncomfortable, so I felt like I can't not go into that deep dive because I need to know what I'm looking at. You know, like I think pretty early on I got through, you know, the first couple hours and I was like, okay, I don't understand anything. I need to stop. So then I did take some time to like read through like history books and then it made so much sense. But then looking back at like baby me before I started learning, like I didn't even recognize the reveal of Fenrir with Odin, and I was like, wow, that was a big one to miss. This is embarrassing. So I was like, okay, like I didn't recognize who the weavers were, similar to the Fates, and I was like, oh God. So yeah, I was very delayed. So yes, it's a big thing. So, you know, if you're not up on your Scandinavian mythology, you might want to brush up.
Sure, but you know, the good news is it makes you want to learn history, right? Like, it's a motivation. That's what we're talking about, the educational power of video games. So good job, Assassin's Creed Valhalla. You probably got a lot of people into Norse history and mythology. Mission accomplished.
Exactly. And this is why I talk to academics all the time. I spend like 80% of my life telling academics, hey, this is really good. It may not be super accurate, but you'll make your students interested to learn. So you should put this in your classroom. And then they don't most of the time.
Missing out.
And I get very sad. And I get very sad. I'm like, why is archaeogaming not a bigger trend in academia? Like, guys, this is cool. There's like a ton of crossover and like valuable lessons that you can glean from both. But I don't know. I definitely play more RPGs, but I know strategies are really popular for classrooms and like stuff like Minecraft. That's like huge, apparently, in academic circles, and I had no idea. I was like, why is Minecraft so popular? I don't know. I still don't really.
Yeah. There's a cool YouTube channel. Is it called Archaeogaming? I forget, but it's a girl who actually teaches detailed archaeological lessons while playing Minecraft, and it's really, really cool, and I recommend people go check it out. I found it serendipitously and I was like, see, this is a great learning tool. Like, games do not rot your brain. They really can educate people and get people interested in this kind of thing, right? Like, you can take any subject matter and turn it into a game, whether it's art, history, math, science, you know, and get people interested in learning.
Well, you've worked in games, so this might be perfect. Just from your perspective of coming from the game side rather than the academic side, obviously we have a ton of historical games that are more the 4X strategy, kind of non-super violent, that parents might be more of a fan of. But then we do have things like Assassin's Creed where, okay, yes, it's got some violence in it and RPG elements, but you can really go and I feel like the exploration is much better in RPGs. So, like, you know, if you were going to suggest or take one of these two distinct styles and say, well, this one might be a little bit easier to get into classrooms or whatever, is there a strong argument for why you should have one type of game versus another one, or does it not really matter?
I think strategy games, because they sort of require like logic and the way they play out, are probably the easier way to get people into learning about history, because there's a formula you can follow about like how to build a civilization and who these leaders are, right? Like, it's sort of built into the system. Like, most history-based games tend to be strategy games. But at the same time, it would be kind of cool if teachers would think outside the box. For example, if you've played a game called Hades, which is a roguelike action RPG, that is really, really well researched when it comes to Greek mythology and a little bit of Greek history. And so that can be a learning tool where kids have fun, like, trying to escape Hades over and over and over again. They die, they get better equipment, they learn more about the story, and then they go. But you unlock more and more information about characters and about Greek mythology and history. And it's done in a very fun, clever way. But those are kind of more difficult arguments because teachers who, if you're not already in the gaming space, you may not appreciate that. So the way to kind of go is like strategy games, which are based, you know, like when my brother was younger, he played this Civil War strategy game all the time on PC. Or you've got someone was just telling me the other day about like Age of Mythology, which is all about like, you know, the gods, the Trojan War or something like that. So I feel like strategy games are probably the entry point because it's the most obvious way to connect history and video games. Even Oregon Trail is basically a role-playing game, right? Like, there is some strategy and some customization involved.
And what about things like tabletop RPGs? I mean, maybe also for like a school environment, do you think it's going to be more, like, it's pretty important to have almost like a physical or interactable component to get you into history? Because, I mean, obviously, strategy, same as RPG, they both, you can't really touch. They're definitely screen-based, but...
Sure. No, absolutely. Anything that is tangible is going to definitely be better for a classroom environment because, you know, you're actually physically there with other students working together, you know, for a common goal, or even if you're playing against each other, it's always better to interact in person, honestly. Now, I am terrible at tabletop games. Let me just say that. For some reason, I always mess up. The last one I played was Cthulhu with my friends at work, and we were all terrible at that game. The point is to survive that game, and none of us survived after like 3 weeks of playing. So we were terrible at it. But it was really fun actually physically interacting with people and, you know, using your imagination and just like physically writing things down or drawing things or whatever. I definitely think that that is another thing that teachers should concentrate on, is like getting everyone together in a shared space and physically and, you know, just emotionally sharing their experience.
And the last kind of gaming that I can think of off the top of my head, do you think escape rooms are a good method of teaching? Or does that one tread the line of like, it could be quite frustrating because if you don't understand it, you're not going to get out, and then you just get mad and then you don't learn anything?
I think if it's done correctly, right? Like, if you get the right people setting up the whole game, it would make sense. Like, escape rooms are fun if everyone cooperates and understands the rules. So if you want to make it like history based, you know, finding that thread to get people in and out is super important. I'm not great at those either, so I leave it to smarter people to figure out how to do that. But again, anything that gets you interested in history, you know, whether it's tabletop games or video games or escape rooms, like having people participate and use their imagination is super important. So I think it's possible that, yeah, escape rooms can be a great learning tool. It just has to be done right.
Yeah, no, it's pretty hard. I frequently sit around and kind of imagine, well, if we were going to do one, because they are kind of fun and interactable, but like, how would you do it? And I think the only thing that people have been able to really come up with was, you know, well, you could do a one that sort of teaches you language, the ancient languages, because you could, you know, put like ancient writing and then try to have people understand it. But even then, that's hard.
See, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard, but that it's absolutely possible. And that would be super fun, right? And people remember it because they're very involved in escaping, right? So they're going to remember those words.
I would hope so. If not, well, then it was terribly put together if you don't remember the thing.
Right.
I wouldn't say I'm particularly good at escape rooms either. But, you know, I have had the great fortune of having a lot of friends who love them. And so I've been invited to participate in quite a lot. And every single one was different and exciting and historical in its own way. I think Like, there was one about the Roswell aliens, and I was like, oh, yes, teach me about government cover-ups and aliens.
Right? It gets you interested.
Yeah, in like 1957 or whatever. And then there was like another one that was like Harry Houdini, and I was like, oh, yes, teach me about this. I know nothing. And then there were some horror ones that I did not willingly go into because I did not think they would be, well, I didn't know they were horror. So I went in and then got the pants basically scared off me. So,
oh, jeez.
You know, it's a struggle.
It is.
But yeah, no, I'm super, super excited to see what people are constantly coming up with. But kind of just to sort of end our discussion about the games themselves, I'm curious to know. So obviously, we archeo game with games because we want to learn about the history within either the setting, if it's in a historical setting, or we learn about the mythologies that maybe they're basing stories around. But I'm curious to know whether you also consider the physical video game itself like a piece of history as well, because there's that sort of lesser talked about aspect, especially within archeo gaming, where we talk so much about history in games, but what about the history of like the game itself as history? Do you cover that?
I don't cover that, although I might have later on some experts who do cover that actual physical aspect of video games, those who work hard to preserve actual video game boxes and cartridges and consoles, because they are a part of our history. You know, one day someone is going to find a bazillion E.T. cartridges out there, you know, of E.T. video games, right? And wonder, what the heck is this? Right. And so by preserving that history, people in the future will have context for it, because I've sort of been alive for a lot of the narrative arc of video games so far. And it's really amazing how it went from, you know, Atari 2600 to Nintendo, which was 8-bit, and then Super Nintendo 16-bit, 32-bit, 64, et cetera. And now we have almost lifelike realistic graphics. So, you know, seeing that now we don't even really have physical copies of things anymore. Everything is digital. And it's actually hard to find physical copies. You have to go to some place like Limited Run to get physical copies of certain games. So I definitely think it is an important part of the discussion. I think video games are a part of history, like actual history. And I'm really glad that there are people writing about it and covering it, because it is so a part of our culture now. I mean, most people, even if they don't consider themselves gamers, they've played video games. You know, if they've played Candy Crush on their phone, that is a video game. You are a gamer. If you play, you know, Marvel Snap, you are a gamer. If you played Farmville back in the day on Facebook or whatever, like, you are a gamer. So gamification of everything has brought everyone together, and we're all sort of a part of that history, and it's important to preserve it.
Yeah, for sure. I couldn't agree more. And now, if we have a lot of games out here, obviously, but do you have a game either set in a certain location or covering a certain mythology or culture that we haven't seen done that you would like to see done sometime soon?
I would like Assassin's Creed to take place in pre-Columbian Mexico. The Aztecs, the Mayans, you know, Teotihuacan, I don't care. Just like cover pre-Columbian times, please, because it's so interesting, so fascinating. It is constantly overlooked. I don't know why, because these were really sophisticated, really amazing cultures. And I'm like, oh, an Assassin's Creed game set, you know, if you're part of the Mayans or the Aztec, or just, it's just right there. And it drives me crazy. We don't have more games that cover pre-Columbian, you know, Mexico and South America.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't know. I understand sort of that they do their own thing, but I mean, I've been sitting here just like, you're only now doing Japan, which is like the most obvious setting. But of course, they waited until after Ghost of Tsushima. So now everyone's like, well, why do we need that? Because now we have Ghost. And you're like, but...
Right? See, that's what happens when you wait too long. You got to jump on the opportunity while you can. And I'm a little frustrated. Like, Codename Jade looks really cool, but Assassin's Creed Codename Jade is actually a mobile title.
Yeah.
And I've been wanting an ancient Chinese setting forever for Assassin's Creed, and it's on a mobile game. And I'm like, oh, there's nothing inherently bad about that, but it's not my favorite way to play games. So I was hoping they would at least have a console version of some sort.
I know, me too. I was like, guys, please. Like, I know that they are doing kind of the I think the Jap Japan one is going to be for major consoles. But yeah, I was very upset. I won't lie. I was like, well, China, but like,
yeah,
not for mobile, please. If I had it my way, like, I mean, I know that the Assassin's Creed franchise is busy expanding and doing like 10,000 other things. So I guess you have Project shunted to the side. But, you know, if I had it my way, I'd be like, well, I know that Codename Hex sounds cool, but I'm like, it's just going to be in like Central Europe doing witch stuff. And I'm like, couldn't that one be the mobile one instead?
Yeah, I feel like they've covered something similar where it's, you know, they haven't been to China, they haven't been to Japan, you know, that's kind of a weird one. It's like, you know, the Blair Witch Project was decades ago. Come on, people, let's catch up. But I don't know, we haven't seen anything really about it, so it could be cool. I'm going to keep an open mind.
Same. I was like, I will keep an open mind for all your future things, but I definitely know that there are big places that I would like to see too. You know, I'd like to see the Aztecs or the Maya. You know, maybe Aztecs and conquistadors. I don't know, something cool. You could easily weave in the mythology of like the Fountain of Youth and De Leon and stuff like that. But
right, exactly, it's right there.
Right, I was like, it's oh, that's so obvious. So I'm sure that they have people who've like brought this up, but I'm sure they also have a method to their development, so we'll just have to wait. But watch, someone's going to develop a game in these settings, and then we're all going to get mad and say, well, now it's too late if you want to do it, because now we have something else.
Right.
So, you know, it's pretty hit or miss at this point. But anyway, yeah, I digress. The gaming space is so fast changing, and you know, it's fast changing for me, and I'm not even like the most intense gamer. So for people within the industry, I can't even imagine what it must feel like to just be like, oh, no, oh, this is new. Oh, okay, this is coming. Wait, you know, having to pick what's coming down the line.
Yeah, there are at least 15 games in the next 3 months that I'm going to have to choose between, and that is not going to be easy.
Okay, but
great problem to have.
Great problem to have. But wait, okay. Is there, like, an all-time history game that you would pick that you could say, like, this is... I don't want to say the pinnacle because we could still develop new stuff, but, like, something, you know, that has a long legacy of being cited as one of the top history games?
Oregon Trail. I mean, it's kind of the first and best. I mean, it is so, like, amazingly accurate to the history, and it's just so much fun to play. So I think that is still my favorite. That's one that has really long legs that you can play at any age. And they occasionally remake it and, you know, remaster it to sort of keep up with the times. But that's kind of the first game that comes to mind. It's just Oregon Trail. Never gets old. Still educational. But, you know, now with more up-to-date versions, it's also more accurate and more fair. So.
Okay. Yeah. No, that's pretty cool. Sticking with it. I love it. Yeah. I don't know. That just popped into my head because I was thinking of, like, this legacy of, like, the Prince of Persia games or like Tomb Raider or something, just because I'm like, oh, people seem to just talk about that all the time and cite it and everything, you know. Oh, something comes out in the desert, oh, it's another Tomb Raider or stuff like that.
Right. Yeah, I mean, those kind of games are fun fantasy games. Like, I love Prince of Persia Sands of Time, but it's not always terribly historically accurate, but, you know, I could probably make a history and games episode out of it. And I have no idea what the new Prince of Persia is going to be about. They changed a lot about it. It still looks cool, but we'll just have to see. But yeah, Oregon Trail is just kind of like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. You know, like they did update some things, right, to be more reflective of history and much more fair. Like, indigenous people were, you know, portrayed in that sort of cowboy Indian way back in the 70s, which isn't accurate at all. But I think they changed that to be much better. So that's the good news. So, but yeah, there's a lot of games that, you know, Civilization does a lot that's good. I mean, you can speak more to that to me as a giant Civilization fan, but a lot of the strategy games sort of have that advantage of, like, they can weave the history in and be more accurate than, say, fantasy games, which are only sort of touching on mythology and history.
For sure. And just to sort of end on a happier note, you know, I saw your show is, you know, a couple years old, and it looks like it's doing well. It's growing. But what does ultimate success look like for you, for your show? Is it just, you know, getting more people invested in the history and video games? Is it getting gamers more interested in history? Is it all of the above? Is there another goal that I cannot think about?
I think it's really trying to get people interested in history. I had a lot of coworkers at IGN, for example, who weren't really into history. I was talking to someone at lunchtime once, and I was making a joke about, you know, Caesar Augustus, and they were like, "Who's Caesar?" And at first I thought they were joking, like they were deadpanning me. And they weren't. And I was like, okay, that's a little strange, because you grew up in the same sort of white American European household, and Caesar was like one of the first things you learn about, and you don't know who that is, or you're blanking, and this needs to be fixed. But I also want to make sure that when I talk about history and games, it's not just Eurocentric, because too much of our history focuses on that. So one of the fun things about video games is more and more they're trying to find interesting angles to cover other civilizations and other cultures. So it's not just a great way to educate people, but a great way to educate myself as well. So learning is the ultimate goal. What does it look like? You know, what does my victory parade look like? That I somehow get like a little mini show on, I don't know, like History Channel or BBC or Netflix or something, right? Like that's kind of the secret goal we all have, or just like somehow we make money and we become famous for this. But even just like teaching people about history and making them interested in it, like that's an accomplishment. I'll take it.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. I mean, I would rather just have people interested and wanting to curate that interest in some way. I don't care how I do it, but if it gets people interested, that's a good stepping stone. So it sounds like you're headed in a good direction, and I sincerely hope that by now you've told your coworker knows who Caesar is now.
Oh, I hope so. I might have to quiz them later. We'll see. If he says anything about pizza, I'm gonna be mad.
I think I'd be more mad if it was salad. If they were like, yes, I know what Caesar is. It's salad. I would be like,
it's salad. Yes. Yes, that's right. Caesar Augustus created the Caesar salad in Mexico. Sure. Whatever.
Oh,
yikes.
Yikes. Okay. Well, I hope that they, for their sake, they know who it is, or learn quickly who it is.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, anyway, I mean, so we've been talking about the legacy of games and sort of the history, and we've run through a lot of these great things, and hopefully it's been kind of a mini history lesson in history and video games and their development. So to keep along with this theme, at the end of each podcast episode, I ask if each of my guests will read Percy Shelley's poem, Ozymandias, because this poem has been quoted and cited by a lot of people as being pretty memorable, one of the more memorable poems that they read. And so after reading it, I'd just be interested to see if you sort of agree with this assessment, and just other general thoughts of, you know, what do you think of this poem?
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
I met a traveler from an antique land who said, "Two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command. Tell that its sculptor well those passions read, which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal, these words appear. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away."
That's a very profound poem. I like it. I do. Right? It makes me wonder, you know, you see these colossal stone statues and great civilizations of the past. And, you know, you wonder how they did it, how they lived their lives, if they lived grander, better lives. And in fact, I was having a conversation with one of my friends about the system's collapse in the Bronze Age, which happens in the 12th century BCE, when all these great civilizations in a short period of time just sort of disappear or they crumble. And then hundreds of years later, you know, the classical Greeks, you know, ancient Romans, they come along and see these ruins of the Minoans and the Mycenaeans and the Hittites. And they think, you know, what is this? Who were these great people? They must have lived in a better time, a golden age or a silver age or a bronze age, but not the garbage iron age, right? And they thought the same thing after the collapse of Rome. Like who were these amazing supermen who created these great monuments? Were they better men than us? And is this a dire warning that this could happen to us as well? There's a lot to unpack here.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and I love how popular culture picks up on it. And I know there have been several pop culture things now with either just the name Ozymandias or something that references the poem in some way. So I love how people pick up on it. And it's funny because I played Shadow of the Colossus, and the only thing I could think the entire time I was like playing that game was Ozymandias. This is all ruins and shit that's gonna fall down.
Right? Like it that's actually a great parallel. It's like, yeah, that is very much Shadow of the Colossus, which is just a very atmospheric, very, I don't know quite how to say it, but just like emotional game. Even though there's like not a lot of talking and there's not a ton of hand holding, but it's a very profound game.
Yeah, I felt like And that's kind of like why I got it, because I didn't, half these games I know nothing about, and I'm like, I guess from the title or the cover art, it sounds good and I'll try it. But yeah, because I found myself thinking it's very like cinematic. It's meant to just be almost like you walk around and you just look at things, right? Like you don't necessarily have to do much. I mean, you can if you want to, but also you can sort of walk around and just look. But yeah, I know it's this idea of monumentality and impermanence, and so I guess like that game and the poem are very, they're kind of mirror images of each other. But I also like it because when you know the background of the poem, it's Shelley was writing this and he was influenced by an old statue of Ramesses II that was uncovered in Egypt, and it was coming to the British Museum, and so he just sat down and wrote this sonnet. And I was like, well, I wish I had those skills, just to look at a statue and then write something this beautiful. But yeah, no, he packs a lot in there, and I think you hit the nail kind of right on the head of, you know, what kind of grand civilization is this, but also is it gonna last? And you know, you can think about it so many different ways, like video games. Are we gonna have video games that stand out, that will still stay great, hopefully for forever? That's debatable. But I think, yeah, that, you know, it speaks at its heart to impermanence and what are we going to think is great? And so kind of in the spirit of all these great thoughts that this poem usually brings up for myself and guests, the last question I kind of ask everyone is, if we take a minute to think about our culture, our contemporary society right now, do we have like a modern Ozymandias, you know, something we think is kind of monumental or great or that it'll be around forever? And but realistically, you know, shoot forward like 500 years, or are future humans gonna agree with our assessment? You know, are they gonna look back at the same kind of games or whatever we have and say, yep, that's great, that's here, it's forever?
Wow. I'm going to try to keep it in the realm of games too, because it's easy to like point to like modern things, like, I don't know, the Statue of Liberty or the Eiffel Tower, right? But we're talking about video games, right? Like, what's that game that's always going to sort of be there, right? And it's going to be probably something that has endured for many decades, like, you know, Pac-Man or Super Mario Brothers, right? So somebody can find, you know, an old copy of the original Nintendo Entertainment System, you know, Super Mario Brothers, or like Duck Hunt or something, right? Like, it'll be one of those really early physical copies of games that sort of pave the way for other video games, right? Like, the sort of the foundation of that. So I think it'll either be like an arcade cabinet that's going to have something like, I don't know, Donkey Kong, or it will be one of the early game cartridges that will have one of the popular games out there. Or people are really going to be confused and think, wow, that E.T. game really was popular. All of these copies just buried together must have been a religious ritual of some kind. I mean, who knows what people will think, you know, 2,000 years from now, when they're just like, who were the Super Mario Brothers? How are they worshipped? You know?
No, it's true. It's true. I was thinking about that the other day, just with like a different example, like Mickey Mouse. Like, I was in a conversation with a friend and I was like, what if our civilization kind of died overnight and then aliens came and then they just found this like giant statue of Mickey Mouse? Are they going to be like, these people are weird. They're worshiping a mouse.
Yeah.
A literal mouse. So it's like the same thing with all these like Nintendo Super Mario World parks and stuff. They'll just come and they'll see like a giant statue of Mario or Peach or Yoshi or something, and be like, are these their gods?
Right? You know, they'll find the Universal theme park and be like, okay, so I guess they, you know, had a ruler named Princess Peach. I mean, who knows what they're going to think? So I applaud all those who are trying to accurately document the narrative arc of video games, so there's not that type of confusion. Although I'm just saying, you know, if you want to assume that we all, you know, worshipped, you know, Link from Legend of Zelda or something, it could be worse.
Could be much worse, actually. There's some great video game characters, you know. Yeah, I wouldn't be mad. Now, there's some definitely I would be kind of mad. I'd be like, we want to choose this. But yeah, no, the jury's out on the games. We'll see. We need to get to 2,000 years from now to see if what we think is great is going to stay that way. So future humans, hopefully they can listen to this podcast episode and then think about it and then have an answer. So yeah, there was so much that I didn't get to, but obviously that always happens with podcasts. I'm sure you encounter that as well. But, you know, I just want to thank you again for coming on the show and talking some game shop. I so rarely get to talk to other gamers who love history. So it's been a kind of fun departure from the normal academic stuff. And yeah, I hope you can come back for something.
Absolutely. Yay, video games.
Yes.
Trireme Transit is now departing Ancient Office Hours. Next stop is Present Ponderings.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.